Blog Talk Radio.
Isn't enough going on around the world to stimulate. We are living in remarkable times. Hello, and welcome to Masonic Effects. I'm going to begin the program with a bit of a departure today, just because I'm chuffed, feeling good. We have an audience that joins us from 21 countries. Thank you. Thank you for the support. I'd like to give that 2021 shout out, do this periodically, just to remind everybody and myself, sit up a little straighter and take things a little more seriously, with the most heartfelt thanks to listeners from Sweden and Denmark, and Netherlands, yeah. Croatia, and the Republic of Serbia, and their sort of nearby neighbors, Greece, thank you, Japan, and to another continent, Cameroon, Australia, yeah, hello, Oman, yeah, India, and Ireland, yep, Belize, and listeners from El Salvador, the United Kingdom, thank you, Chile, South Sudan, the USA, Peru, Uganda, and Canada. We are an interesting mix, aren't we not? An interesting mix from around the world. I'm very happy to be able to provide you with something worthwhile. And we'll do that today's show. Without any fear of contradiction, this is a pretty good one. Every so often, you know, you're doing some interesting work and you're leaning in, and every so often it just step it up a gear. Well, that's what we've done here this week. We have some incredible music. Charlie Parker and Coleman Hawkins, just amazing. Just amazing, the music, and Lester Young and Bill Evans and John Coltrane. It started off with the Keith Jarrett Trio. The poetry today, this has been sitting on my shelf. I was complaining to myself yesterday about me trying to find a copy of this for today. And then I stepped back and went over to my bookshelf and found my old copy. Back when a book, this cost me $1.50. I'm talking about one of the most renowned writers in the history of English language, John Milton. Some have claimed, next to William Shakespeare, he's the he has that level of significance. So we're going to, of course, how would he read 12 books of poetry? And that's what Paradise Lost is about. I'm not going to do that. No, that would be painful. But today we'll share an outline of the man and an outline of the poetry. And if it stimulates, that's great. I think it will be of some interest to you out there. And if you've heard it, no reason to be afraid of the darn thing. Better always, it's like realizing what you've lost when it's gone. If you've ever had the pleasure of going to theater with an expert in drama, I can tell you it's an overwhelming experience. Masonry offers us that. We have this sense, this faceless apparition with us all the time, this expertise. Not doubting us, but helping us connect, helping us overcome that sense of the wrong notes that we seem to play as we go along, and to remind us that those are value judgments. And it inspires us to realize what we see, what the eye see, not what the brain tells us we see. The eye shows us what is. Without judgment. And when we get around to understanding how harsh we are with ourselves and how that shows in the world around us, you know, that difference in authenticity, you know, all that tedious character building stuff. Well, it's always there. Not as a harshness, not as a tether, not as harness, but as that mischievous little voice that says, what's that about? What do you understand? And why are you determining that you can't do something before you've really given it proof? Here, we're going to give that a try. The title of the commentary today, Purpose. Lofty. I admit it's an ambitious little program today, but at the end of it, you be the judge. You tell me again whether it's been satisfying. In the meantime, the day is moving on. My goodness, we have the work of masonry happening all over the world, which is kind of interesting. Better that we focus on the work and not try to answer or ask ourselves how it happens. Not too much, not too often. That it happens is quite revealing. There is no template. This is not a stencil. You're not going to be a carbon copy of me, and neither am I to of you. It is a delightful play on the philosophers. Maybe that's part of the unconsciously why I'm bringing a poem to you about the dead philosophers, you know, a poem about. It separates out our what we want from what we need by teaching us. It helps us to understand more about ourselves by learning more about other people, not in that politeful, pedestrian way that is so, the superficiality, although it has its place, but in the sense that you mean it, when you're meandering around, or all of a sudden you wake up and realize that things are moving a little too fast, and it's not the world around that's fast, it's us. The amount of time that we have on this earth is brief by comparison. And to spend all of that time with a wrinkled up little face, with our fists balled up, being intemperate, seems to be a bit frivolous. Handling differences, it's one thing to talk about learning to explore debate and conversation to illustrate the deeper differences between you and your guest. It's a whole other thing to realize what you learn from that experience. And then there's that process of learning the tolerance required. And so if you're wondering why everybody doesn't think as acutely or as intensely as you, they're off on their own process. There is a humanism about masonry. It is our own conceits that leave us thinking that we have some power over or influence over what's happening around us. And we're observers at the best. We are observers, and we are influenced tremendously, tremendously. So how do you want to be influenced? Maybe that is that finding your truest nature? Or is it a false belief that we can be somehow better than what we truly are? I think we're contained within the scope of our imagination and our intelligence. And I don't know if we can best that. I really don't. I know I can think that I'm besting it, and I can think about being more convenient and more compatible with the people around me, because that matters. You can learn to enjoy your own company without feeling that something is wrong if you're not sitting with other people around you. Each to their own. Do we improve the fundamental personalities, or do we change the personality? Well, maybe masonry is the anecdote to that old bromide. You can't change, a leopard doesn't change its spots, eh? Maybe it is. It's reputation is very, very much a driving factor for Freemasons and the world. We are a sense of presence and continuity. Whether people are accommodating or sympathetic to our notions or not, my goodness. A thoughtful Mason would join them and say, well, no, I'm not comfortable, or I realize that my thinking changes year by year, and so I can allow that same measure to you. I don't need the pettiness of jumping in. Umbrage doesn't necessarily govern the world that we live in. It's and it gets carried away. We're learning to adjust. If you were to what's going on with this alleged freedom of the internet to be able to say things without accountability, apparently without accountability, But we know when whatever we write and how bold we are, do you think it would be any different for the pamphleteers in the 17th century, 16th century? Well, we're going to hear from one of them, John Milton, today. Sample it. Any more destructive or any more sympathetic for the irritations that he's causing? There are certain causes that men have pushed back on. Not all men, but despotism, autocracy. Today, oligarchs are preying on on our systems of democracy and using an economic theory that so far it's starting to cause some strain. You're rising above all of that. How do we do that? Well, I think you can think that we can divorce ourselves from any of these notions, or is it so invalidating to think of ourselves in this torrential sea, this confused sea state, as that tiny chip of wood floating along, being buffeted by the elements? But we're floating along. And there'll be slack periods and calm. And when the turmoil happens, we continue just to float along because the current, that energy is taking us from somewhere to somewhere. To understand our own thought, how we process all of this. We take for granted things that are challenging. Hmm? Time and space and understanding. Sit back. Fill your cup with whatever strikes your fancy right now. And we'll see where we go together. Thank you. I'm guessing you're enjoying the vibe. I guess that's how you'd say it. Not bad, eh? Purpose. It isn't for nothing that the story of our history has been passed along through the centuries. The pieces fall into place for fewer men than you might guess. It seems to happen when he comes in contact with the feeling that he has when he holds the thought of the masonry. The appeal is not what it answers, but what it asks. The value is not what is asked, but what answers we give and how we go about answering. So many metaphors, only a hint of self-discipline needed. The Gestalt, it reckons with awareness. One does not find that what he hears, but what he perceives of life. Mishi tells us art is the fundamental metaphysical activity of man. I wonder if we don't articulate that, does it still affect, you know, like the tree falls in the forest when no one's around? Can you still hear the sound? Fundamental metaphysical activity of man. It is less an assertion than a question. What is he talking about? Art, as according to ritual, we are able to study, or art, that is, paint and paper. When we walk away from our ritual, many forget during the event. He was not in the room present. The words are about him, not of him. What questions are put to him are answered as if he does not have agency. Only when he asks the question of himself does he begin to benefit from the answers he discovers. Moment by moment, first any answer, gradually the answer. Questions trigger ideas, or they are ignored. Poets tell us this repeatedly. We walk through life with an ability to connect our spirit with the surroundings, or distracted and disconnected. The questions reveal the precision of thinking, which is another way of saying they reveal whether we matter, whether we take ourselves seriously enough to ask questions that others mock. Until that day, that moment when life comes together with the death. What say you then? Continuity? You know, some notion of immortality? Or is that the moment of complete understanding, that resolution? Returning home. Here, this will help you. Thank you. Are the primary metaphysical activity of mankind, then perhaps we've all just made a connection with that or a contribution today in our own small way. How to approach this poetry was easy. It's not trying to describe. I would not be so arrogant. This is more an exposure, just a slight look at into the workings of an interesting mind, a tremendous mind. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time telling you about John Milton. He's born in 1608 and he died in 1674. We think he died in London. He was a poet and a pamphleteer. You know, back at a time when spreading information, just like it is today, spreading information and opinion was considered the antithesis of good government. It was going on because there was tyranny. There were things happening that were unsettling to a careful or considerate people. This poem, Paradise Lost, is considered his best, and it's widely regarded, not my words, the greatest epic poem in English. Now we want to know what in the world is an epic poem, but that's the type of thing that the interested amongst us can do. In his work, Milton advocated the abolition of the Church of England, Henry VIII's invention, and he advocated the execution of Charles I, regicide. Now, from the beginning of the English Civil Wars in 1642 to long after the restoration of Charles II, Charles I's son, in 1660, he espoused in all his works of political philosophy that opposed tyranny and state-sanctioned religion. His influence extended not only through the Civil Wars and to Tuareg, but also to the American and French revolutions. In his works on theology, he valued liberty of conscience, the paramount importance of scripture as a guide in matters of faith and religious toleration toward dissidents. And as a civil servant, Milton became the voice of the English Commonwealth after 1649 through his handling of its international correspondence and his defense of the government against polemical attacks from abroad. Anyway, his dad, staunch Roman Catholic, expelled his son John, the poet's father, from the family home in Oxfordshire for reading an English Bible, Protestant Bible. Banished and disinherited, he went to London, set up a business as a scrivener, preparing documents for legal transactions. He was also a money lender, and he negotiated with creditors to arrange for loans on behalf of his clients. That's the background, yeah? Paradise Lost. It is of, well, my copy was printed in 1962, but it's a poem in 12 books. It's one of the late works of Milton. It was originally issued in 10 books in 1667, but some of the material, books 7 and 10 were each split into two parts. Many scholars consider Paradise Lost one of the greatest poems in the English language. It tells the biblical story of the fall from grace of Adam and Eve, and by extension all humanity, in a language that is a supreme achievement of rhythm and sound. And for those of you searching through our Masonic ritual for rhythm, this might be something interesting for you. In the 12-book structure, the technique beginning in Medeas Res, or in the middle of the story, the invocation of the muse and the use of the epic question are all classically inspired. The main characters, God, Lucifer or Satan, Adam and Eve. Much has been written about Milton's powerful and sympathetic characterization of Satan. The romantic poets William Blake and Percy Bysshe Shelley saw Satan as the real hero of the poem and applauded his rebellion against the tyranny of heaven. My. How do you go beyond that? Where do you go with that? The beginning of Paradise Lost is similar in gravity and seriousness to the book from which Milton takes much of its story, the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible. The Bible begins with the story of the world's creation. Milton's epic begins in a similar vein, alluding to the creation of the world by the Holy Spirit. The first two sentences, or 26 lines of Paradise Lost, are extremely compressed, containing a great deal of information about Milton's reasons for writing his epic. I'm not going to get into that with you today. This is on a huge scale. So how in the world could anybody just handle this in passing? This is a main course, an intellectual main course. Milton manages to tell us quite a lot about how he sees his project. And in the first place, an invocation to the muse at the beginning of an epic is conventional. Milton thus begins his poem with a mixture of towering ambition and humble self-effacement, tipping his hat to his poetic forebears and promising to soar above them for God's glorification. Here's just the argument from book one. Man's disobedience and the loss thereupon of paradise wherein he was placed. This touches the cause of his fall, the serpent, or rather Satan in the serpent. And the lines go something like this. Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe. With loss of Eden till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Sing heavenly muse that on the secret top of Oreb or Sinai didst inspire that shepherd who first taught the chosen seed. battles and heroes and conscience. This suggests to us, as Genesis does, that our capacity for reason and doubt is somehow a failing. And the product of forces that cause disharmony. I don't know. Thank you. We turn to Masonic history. Yeah. Not as a billboard reporting on somebody else, but I'd like you to think that we are no different or little different, except for outward appearances, perhaps, than we were hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Just look for the similarities. Around the world, this process of masonry has been well received. It is contentious. As you would expect from something as either complicated or as simplistic as Freemasonry. Whether you and your friends are off exploring the depths of metaphysics or looking at the practical elements of understanding the application of working tools, your work is purposeful. What we've discovered in the 20, what I've discovered in the 21st century, or I see, is a lot of proselytizing, especially in the jurisdiction that I'm in. Not malignant, but misguided. It seems to be a considerable amount of confusion about how to describe for the menu of Freemasonry so that a new fellow coming into our order will be able to make selections and tailor his experience to his own taste and ability. This work that I'm going to get into today is, and I'd like you to keep in mind, is the difference between, talk about an espresso or a cappuccino, as a very dear friend of mine enjoys. It's the difference between a swallow and a taste. If it matters to you, it matters. But creating that menu, whether you're equipped with a respectable vocabulary or you're using the accuracy of geometries and mathematics, there is a harmony. And we're going to look today into the period where we're seeing evidence of that very same, the same process is happening hundreds of years ago. Hindsight, I'm hoping this equips us with a sense of hindsight. We can't just conjure our history out of thin air. I'm not here to be an apologist for Dr. Anderson's early history of Freemasonry. He was struck with the task of doing it and come up with a history. So it's fanciful. It's that blend of origin and analogy. Yeah, it is. So it's imperative that it was re-examined and challenges made. He was serving a purpose. But we can't stand on firm foundations that are based on conjecture. That's not the way life works. That's superstition, I think. So we're really revolving around the records that came out of the 1730s, again in Dundee. We know a tremendous amount. Somebody was articulate, the secretary took the time to write and tell us more than this kind of dross that we get today. There were 16 people in the room and we opened here and we closed here. So we did the business there. No, these were people that were putting a texture to the meetings. nominations were now held for the election of officers who would have the power and authority to appoint a quorum of the operative brethren, not exceeding five in number, to visit and inspect the work done by other masons. By 1737, rolls were being called and votes marked, and elections were carried by a plurality. In every sense, power was decidedly shifted into the hands of the gentlemen Freemasons, who will oversee the work of their operative brethren. The way this is articulated sets this up as if the gentlemen Freemasons are the villains. And this is, goes back to a period in thinking where anything natural was better and pure and wonderful. We know, well, I'll leave that for you. Yet in this instance, and in contrast with the hostility shown to the protective practices of the working Masons that are described in the 1723 constitutions, the gentlemen Freemasons of Dundee did continue to protect the freedom of their working brethren by permitting only initiated Masons to work in the town. Throughout the rest of the century, some efforts were made intermittently to restrict the practice of the craft to members of the lodge. In other words, who became a Freemason to practice Masonry. The charitable obligations of the lodge also continued to be important, and it proudly maintained its locked pew in the local church. Yet, increasingly, its records speak of the liberty of the Freemason as more and more gentlemen, as well as relatives of practicing Masons, are admitted to the society. From the early 18th century, the signs of increasing literacy also became more frequent. The marks and rough, uncertain scrawl by which the majority of brethren signed their names in the 17th century gave way, and eventually by the 1750s, all but disappear, even among the craftsmen who remain. Literacy. In the 1650s, Mason spoke of the blessings of God and the better ordering of our common will. And they made reference to their craft as the calling. In Dundee, these same craftsmen invoked the Trinity, opening their lodge in 1659 with words taken from the so-called old charges, rules widely practiced by lodges throughout England. The might of the Father of Heaven, with the wisdom of the glorious Son, and the grace and goodness of the Holy Ghost to be with us all at our beginning. Concomitant with evidence of increasing literacy and fewer operatives, the old religious language all but disappears. In its place stands reference solely to the great architect of the universe. In the 1740s, the prospective candidates for admission as operatives were tested by an essay of an architect. Now, however, requiring an arithmetic knowledge of Ionic proportions. The imposition of order, always one of the goals of a guild or lodge, has been extended to include a simplified conception of the deity, as well as sound fiscal management of the lodge. Lodge discipline also included correct social behavior, as well as the professionalism of skills, all now being adjudicated by the gentlemanly leadership of the lodge. Fines were occasionally extracted for infringements of the rules concerning employment. By the same token, money was also lent at interest to assist in business ventures, with the lodge operating at moments like a bank, an institution that did not come to Dundee until the 1760s. in this fascinating instance, the consolidation of elite culture, a process historians have traced as underway from well back in the 17th century, including the assimilation and transformation of one of the most representative institutions of early modern European popular culture, the Guild, complete with its myths and rituals, has been embraced only to be transformed, and its most binding and potentially subversive practice, secrecy, has been given new meaning. Knowledge of the secrets delineated by their brothers, by their degrees. It also enveloped their private association and made it special. For some, in a different setting, it may also have made it suspect. You see the changes that were happening. Is there any reason for us to think that that process, although we use a language, well, some, I've used a language that suggests otherwise, the change has always been part of been a necessity. And hopefully the changes that we make are handled by scholars. I mean, even today, I know that we're finding some very astute gentlemen looking into the rhythms of ritual. Can you imagine the changes that were made in a word or a phrase so that arcane language would not be lost to us? The meaning was more important than the wording. Imagine recognizing that there's the possibility of a rhythm, the harmonics. It certainly takes us full circle to the question of metaphysics and the notion of the arts. Perhaps that's a topic that we'll get into soon. The music and harmonics of masonry. Here, Charlie Parker and Coleman Hawkins. Thank you. I hope that you've enjoyed the program, and thank you for sitting in with us. It's been a pleasure. Couldn't do it without you. Next week, we continue on our stroll through masonry, and remember, it's your call about your business. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. The part that is most intriguing is if you can do it, demonstrate some level, the higher levels of charity without anybody being aware. Can you imagine? Yeah, it's hard to believe, isn't it? Just take care of yourselves, particularly through this pandemic. I'll see you again soon. Bye.